So, of course, it's Palm Sunday, but we've already done Palm Sunday in our journey through Matthew a few weeks ago. So we're not going to do Palm Sunday this morning, although watch for a reference to it. Okay. So we're getting into Matthew chapter 24. At the end of chapter 23, following his woes on the scribes and the Pharisees, Jesus, recorded his final words to a public audience at the end of that chapter. And it was a lament. O Jerusalem, O Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. If you read through the Gospels, you'll notice that Matthew often parallels Mark. They stay very close together in most of the incidents that they talk about. In this case, after this lament, Mark has one that Matthew doesn't. But I think Matthew skips that for a reason. I think that following Jesus' words here, the next Jesus does is somewhat of a symbolic gesture. He leaves the temple for the last time. He abandons the temple. Jesus left the temple and was going away, and his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, you see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. I like this rendering of the Temple Mount and the entrances to it because it gives you a sense of the size of that place that I think is hard for us to understand sometime. It was a huge building. And interestingly enough, it was the Ephesians, the Greeks talked about the temple to Artemis in Ephesus. And if you ever look up, the ancient wonders of the ancient world, the architectural wonders, you're going to find it listed there. They considered it one of those. The temple in Jerusalem was bigger and more magnificent than it was, although it didn't get the recognition from the Greco-Roman world. Tell you a little bit about it. Another graphic here. They started building this complex around the second temple that was built after the Jews came back. Herod the Great began the project in 20 BC. It didn't get done until 63 AD. So this was a long project. This area of the temple here, those temple walls, set on that platform is 35 acres. That's over 26 football fields, to kind of give you a perspective on it. It was built up on a set of retaining walls that the average weight of the stones in those walls are 4 to 5 tons. There's one stone on the southern wall that's about 40 feet long and 400 tons. Now, this is all done with manual labor. A few horses, donkeys, things like that, but without the modern machinery. It was huge. It's quite a project. Jesus solemnly declared that this place, we're looking at that, if you imagine that first picture we saw, not one stone would be left on another. Tearing that down was just a project. As he often did, Jesus spoke with a little bit of hyperbole when he said that. In 70 AD, after the end of the siege of Jerusalem, when the Roman legions began tearing the city down, they did leave one portion of the Western Wall that the Jews call the Wailing Wall today. And you can still see pictures of that. He left the temple, he left the city of Jerusalem with his disciples, and they went up to the Mount of Olives, and he sat down there. Now, in the first century, when you're seated, this is the place that you do your teaching from. So the disciples took the opportunity to come to him privately, it says here, saying, "Tell us when these things will be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age." Now, for Mark, we know that it was just four of the disciples that did this. The two sets of brothers, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. They came to him privately, and he asked him these questions. Their view of the whole place would have been great from the top of the Mount of Olives. It's interesting that the disciples, probably prompted by his statement about the stones not being one on top of the other, they didn't question that this might happen. They had been around Jesus long enough now that they had some confidence in what he said, and that what he said meant something serious. But they wanted to know when. When is this going to happen? When is this going to happen? He really asked two questions there, and I've kind of laid them out a little more literally here so you can see them. When these things will be, what these things are, probably immediately the destruction of Jerusalem, destruction of the temple, and what the sign will be, the one of your coming and also the end of the age. So those are the questions that they asked him, and that's what the rest of chapter 24 and 25 are about. It's Jesus' answer to those questions. These two chapters, usually referred to as the Olivet Discourse, because it's on the Mount of Olives, are the fifth of the discourses that form the framework for Matthew's Gospel. They also get into that topic or that area of theology called eschatology, the study of the last things. Probably no more contentious area of theology exists in the Christian church than eschatology. And these are, there's lots of disagreement on what's involved with this and what these things mean. But Matthew 24 and 25 sometimes form the core of that contention, that debate, that disagreement. Now, I say that because I'm going to present a particular view of what this passage is about. I'm going to get started on it anyway. I'm going to do verse 31, then Marty's going to pick it up after that. But I do that knowing that you may not agree with it. That's fine. The positions on what this passage talks about have quite a spectrum to them. They go all the way from one end, which says that Matthew's account never answered question one at all, and nothing in Matthew 24 and 25 has to do with the church, to the other end, where the first 35 verses have to do with answering question one, and the rest of 24 and 25 answer question two. And you got all points in between. And you know what? They're all Orthodox Christian. When we divide ourselves, in some loving way over these issues, we're not doing a very good job of representing the Lord. So my approach is going to kind of follow that center group. One group within that, one part of that, one of the things they observe is that Jesus often spoke as the prophets spoke. And one of the things that the Old Testament prophets did is they often kind of shifted back and forth between the near-term and the long-term fulfillments of their prophecies. And so I'm going to adopt that position that we got some shifting kind of going on in here. And I'm going to try to couple that with two key themes that I think help us understand what Jesus is trying to communicate in this passage. You can think of the answer to question one as the near term. When are these things going to happen to the temple in Jerusalem? And you think of the answer to question number two as the long term. Now, the disciples came to Jesus, they didn't separate the two out. They thought maybe they were going to come right together. But they didn't. So we understand now, looking back on it, okay, you got these kind of two different, and I'm going to be referring to the long term or the long view and the near view here as I kind of go through this. So little outline of what I'm going to try to do. Put it on a graph. Okay. Got the near view and the longer view. Answer the question one, answer the question two. Now, the first four verses we'll be talking about get a start on this. They're mostly about the longer view, but they kind of get an introduction. So they kind of bridge this a little bit. And then Jesus shifts to the longer view in verses 9 through 14, shifts back to the shorter view in 15 through 20, shifts back to the longer view in 21 through 31, and then when Marty takes over with verse 32, he shifted back to the nearer view and then introduces, really, that's why I kind of have that all cleared out there, the rest of chapter 24 and 25, which is all about the longer view. That's the one piece that most commentators and scholars agree on, that from 35 on, after 36 on, is all one way. So this is how we're going to look at this. So let's get into this thing. All right, first one. And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these things are but the beginning of birth pangs." Jesus began by warning his disciples that there will be many who will come claiming to represent him, claiming to be the Christ. In fact, during Jesus' lifetime, and even before, there were people who claimed to be the Christ, the Messiah, led revolts against the Romans. Throughout church history, there have been those who have claimed to speak for Jesus. And they have some new revelation that's going to be an addition to or perhaps a supplemental to what we have in the teachings of the gospel of the kingdom. Jesus talked about there being wars and rumors of wars. Talked to that kingdoms rising against one another and nations rising against one another. Famines, earthquakes. Those things were all happening in the first century around the world. Those things were all happening in the centuries prior to the first century. And those things have been happening in the world since the first century. Welcome to human history. Jesus offered two commands or imperatives as you think about these things. One is, see that no one leads you astray. No one deceives you or misleads you. Now, how do we do that? Well, we do that by being sure we know what the Scripture says on all those critical issues that have to do with Christianity. We need to be true to the teachings of Jesus and the designated disciples of his that wrote the New Testament for us or oversaw the writing of the New Testament for us. That's our core. That's what we need to know. If you know those things, if you stay engaged in those things, it's going to help from being deceived. The second thing we're supposed to do is not panic. See that you are not alarmed or panicked or troubled by these things. Do you watch the news and get a little troubled about what you're seeing? Watch out. Not supposed to be doing that. Jesus says, don't do that. Now, the reason why his followers should not be easily deceived or alarmed is because we can be assured the end is not yet. The longer view included events leading up to the Jewish revolt of 66 AD, as well as the subsequent history after that, including church history. the followers of Jesus may find themselves in circumstances that seem like the end of the world, but the violence and suffering and catastrophe that they knew by rumor or by personal experience was but the beginning of birth pangs. And that's one of the keys to this passage, but the beginning of birth pangs. This metaphor, I think, is something that helps us understand. And you know, it's not the only place we see it used in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul used it too. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together as in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we await eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. Have you ever connected those two? You don't have to answer that question. It's really, there's only one other place in the New Testament where it talks about birth pangs that, you know, you could connect to this. It's in Jesus' words to his disciples in John chapter 16. But the these two, I think Paul is picking up here not on a new idea, but on what he heard conveyed to him by the apostles of Jesus in this final words. Paul was speaking of the realities of life in a fallen world, the sufferings of this life. Peter described Christians as being sojourners and exiles in a world to which we don't really belong. This metaphor of birth pains, in the midst of that, is where the church would be built. It's the world we live in. When we look at the things going on around us, and it seems like anymore, we get daily warnings of an existential crisis coming at, you know, any time now. We're not to be led astray by those things. We're not to be panicked or troubled over those things. But in the meantime, that doesn't mean it's all going to be all rosy. And they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another, and many false prophets will arise and lead many astray, who because of lawlessness will be increased. The love of many will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. The word tribulation here, translated tribulation here, is the second key to this passage. It's translated in other English translations as delivered over to persecution or be persecuted. The original hearers or readers of this talk, or the readers of Matthew's gospel, would have noted the same word was used two more times in verses 21 and 29. If your translation doesn't have the same word there, now you know it's the same word that we're using in all three places. And that it would suggest that there's an important thread here of some kind that Jesus is getting at. The only previous usage of this word in Matthew was in the parables of the kingdom, interestingly enough, and I think it applies. Specifically, the parable of the sower, if you want to think about that. The rocky ground represented the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, yet he has no root in himself, but endures for a while, and when tribulation and persecution arises on account of the word, immediately he falls away. It's the same word that we have used here in Matthew 24, many fall away. Jesus had in view, I think, the full sweep of church history here, the longer view. He described the realities of persecution, even betrayal. There's an amazing parallel between a lot of what Jesus describes here and what he told his 12 disciples when he commissioned them back in chapter 10, what they can expect. He predicted the damage that would be done by false prophets and the increase in lawlessness. Many will be led astray. The love of many will grow cold. His church would be hated by all nations. But the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world to those same nations that hated it before the end comes. After all the people of God that he has chosen before the foundation of the world have been brought into the body of Christ, then the end will come. Jesus now shifted to the near view, the destruction of Jerusalem. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go in to take what is in his house. Let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas for the women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. Now these, as identified by the word Judea, are all pictures right out of the first century, right out of the contemporary time period with when these things were spoken. Jesus didn't answer question one in the terms of a specific date, but he did offer an event. Something similar to the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. And of course, as the princely says, you all understand what that is, right? To the Jewish readers and hearers of Matthew's gospel, they would have most likely made a connection someplace you probably wouldn't. First Maccabees, one of the apocryphal books to the Protestants, the deuterocanonical books to the Lutherans and Episcopalians, and the canonical book to the Catholics. What that said, First Maccabees chapter 1 says, is that this fulfillment of Daniel took place in 167 BC, when Antiochus Epiphanes entered Jerusalem, he sacked the city, and he offered sacrifice of a swine on the Jewish altar, just to make it doubly bad, ransacked the city, and what that led to was the Maccabean revolt. It went on from 167 BC to 164 BC and established the Hasmonean dynasty that preceded Herod. That's where they got the land back. While specific details are not provided by Jesus, there are several incidents of desecration of the temple, actually by the Zealots, at the siege of Jerusalem. Now, doesn't specify any of those. But he does say that watch for something like this to happen. So what did they, how did that work out? Well, interestingly enough, even though we don't really understand much about this, it's pretty clear that the followers of Jesus listened. And in fact, they, most of them, fled not to the hills, but to the areas, Jewish communities around the Mediterranean before the sack of Jerusalem. Now, they did that at a good time because these warnings about hesitation that he has here, people in the first century, their tops of their houses were like patios. They usually had a stair down the side. And Jesus is saying, hey, if you're up there and you see this happening, don't even bother going back down to the house and getting stuff. Get out of there. Same thing is true for the person in the field who maybe took their cloak off when the day got hotter as they were working. When you see something like this happen, just leave. And man, just hope you're not one of these women who is nursing or long way along in pregnancy when you have to do this. It's going to be tough. It's going to be difficult if it's in the winter because of the rains and the roads flooding and streams you have to ford. And hope it doesn't happen on the Sabbath, because the Jews enforced that pretty strictly. And you couldn't be, you know, you're not going to get away with putting a bunch of stuff on a pack animal and taking a long trip on a Sabbath. And in fact, by around 68 A.D., the Zealots had closed the gates to Jerusalem and wouldn't let anybody out. Further warnings, you know, that you have, they worked. This warning worked. Whether we understand exactly what this said or not, apparently the early church did, because we got good evidence that they did took this to heart and got out of there before the Romans completely obliterated everything. Now, the next passage gets a little more interesting for us. For then there will be great tribulation, says, has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Now, there's pretty heated debate sometimes about whether this particular verses need to be attached to the ones I just read or not. Is this about the siege of Jerusalem, or is this about something else? A couple things to consider here is this phrase that starts out, for then there will be, is such that it could mean at the same time as the things happening before, but it can also mean something that happened afterwards, subsequent history, even distant history to some extent. So I believe this was a longer view piece that we have going on here. The word tribulation, I think, is the key. The last time we see that, previously at the beginning of the passage, is talking about the longer view. I think the tribulation here is talking about the longer view as well. Now, this is a phrase, place where you have the phrase, the great tribulation, or a great tribulation. Now, the word great can mean anything that has to do with an upper range or scale of any kind. It could be importance. It could be size. It could be intensity. It could be duration. Now, I take this to be, I'm going to give you some reasons why I like to put this with the longer view. First one is that it's characterized here as anything that is greater than anything from the beginning of the world until now, when Jesus was speaking. Now, as terrible as the destruction of Jerusalem was in 70 AD, it was not as great as numerous examples of human depravity in the millennia since then. In fact, there's a good case that can be made that probably one of the most destructive centuries of human history was the 20th century, the most recent one. Another reason is that late in the first century, after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the Apostle John considered himself to be in the tribulation. He wrote in the beginning of Revelation, I, John, your brother and partner in the tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance that is in Jesus. That's what we're to be about, those things. We're in tribulation, we're in the kingdom, they're already not yet part of it, the beginning of it, and patient endurance. When we see the word tribulation again, here's another reason. When we get to verse 29, we're going to see that it's associated with the return of Christ. Finally, the phrase great tribulation, those two words together, are only found in the New Testament in four places. A couple of them just have to do with individual cases of things. But two of them appear to be related to the same events. One of them's here in Matthew 24, and the other one is in the visions of the Apostle John in Revelation 7. Hint, the quiz is coming up. After this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God, who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." That's the ultimate Palm Sunday, by the way. Then one of the elders addressed me, saying, "Who are these clothed in white robes, and from where have they come?" And I said to him, "Sir, you know." And he said to me, "These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." In the letter at the beginning of Revelation, the book Revelation, the letter to the church at Sardis, we read that the one who conquers will be clothed thus in white garments and will never blot his name out of the book of life. I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. So kind of back to our text here. The great tribulation is, first of all, I think, great by virtue of duration. It's lasted a long time. We think, when's it ever going to end? It's compounded by the intensity of suffering inflicted on the church over those centuries. Jesus already predicted that his followers will be hated by all the nations for his name's sake. Such tribulation can never be equaled because Christ's return will establish the kingdom, which will be in the new heaven and new earth, and there won't be any tribulation. Jesus already talked about that in verses 12 and 13 above. He predicted that during this tribulation period, this long slog, this place where it's all about endurance, remember, those who endured will be saved. Patient endurance that John talked about even in the first century. It says during the time there will be an increasing lawlessness, causing the love of many to grow cold. Even with the endurance of the faithful, the direction of human nature in this fallen world is only going to go one way. Left to itself, it would go to an environment in which no human being would be saved. But God will not let it get to that point. He's going to cut it off for the sake of the elect before then. Jesus now kind of doubled down on his talking about prediction of this powerful deception that would come during this tribulation. "Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is a Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the wilderness,' do not go out. If they say, 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather." The sense of warning appears to be that false Christs are talking about a return of Jesus that somehow we missed. It doesn't matter what they're saying or how they're saying it. Jesus says, "Do not believe it. It hasn't happened yet." Even if such false Christs and false prophets perform great signs and wonders, and even if some who profess to be Christian believe it, Jesus says, "Do not believe it. I told you beforehand this would happen. Don't be surprised." Earlier in his ministry, Jesus had warned about false prophets in the Sermon on the Mount. "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves." At the final judgment, he says, "Many will say, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do mighty works in your name?' And I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness.'" We've seen that word before here too. The same goes for those who claiming he's returned and is in the wilderness or the inner rooms, some sort of secret return of some kind that is just revealed to a few. And if you want to become one of the initiated, you know, we'll let you in on this secret. The gullibility of human nature to the claims and promises of secret knowledges has plagued the church from the Gnostic heresies of the second century to the conspiracy theories of today. There will be nothing subtle or hidden about the coming of the Son of Man. It'll be as obvious as sheet lightning that fills the sky from the east to the west. If you've ever seen that, well, I think most of you probably have. It does. It lights up the whole thing. The final phrase here, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather, was probably a proverbial saying that had some greater significance to the original hearers of these things. There are a number of explanations offered as to why it would be used in the context of the return of Jesus. Most commentators caution about reading too much into it, and I'm going to take that advice. Jesus brought his final answer to question two to a close in this last section. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds and from one end of heaven to the other. This is the final occurrence of the word tribulation. We got three of them now. And the grammar of the text actually confirms that it's to be connected with the previous two. All three are singular, pointing to some single period or event, set rather than just one compact one. Jesus predicted that his public return would be the end of human history, and it would happen immediately after the tribulation, after it's done, finally ended. The description was almost entirely woven together from Old Testament prophecies, pieces of Old Testament prophecies. The last four phrases in verse 29 are set in verse format, as I've done here in many English translations. That description of the first three stanzas is interesting about the sun, the moon, and the stars. And it paints a picture of the absence of any natural light that could be seen from earth. Absolute, utter darkness. The meaning of the fourth stanza is less clear. It could be referring to what Paul talked about in his letter to the Ephesians. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers and against the authorities, against cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. Or it could be referring to the disruption of other natural phenomena besides light at this time. In any case, this primary image of one of utter darkness is the atmosphere, or the situation into which the sign of the Son of Man will appear. This is a sign of the coming of the end of the age that the disciples had talked about. Jesus offered no further information about what the sign would be exactly. The Greek text is kind of ambiguous in that it could be understood as the sign which is the Son of Man or the sign of the Son of Man. And the word sign can be translated ensign or banner. There's some people that argue that that's a better translation for that. Whatever it will be, everyone will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. The light that will displace this utter darkness will not be any natural light. It will be the light of the glory of God. Throughout the scripture, clouds and presence of angels are associated with God. We don't want to miss the importance of the great glory associated with the return of Jesus here. The glory is not borrowed from God. The glory is the glory of God. There are two groups of people in this picture, all the tribes of the earth. Interesting the use of tribes instead of peoples or nations. The point may be that even the smallest subgroup is affected. Everyone will see. In the case of some, their reaction will be mourning. They will not rejoice at the coming of the Son of Man. They'll lament. There is no more opportunity to change your mind about who he is. And the other group is the elect that we've talked about already. Those longing for his coming. And at the sound of a loud trumpet, it says, the angels of the Son of Man will gather his people from the four winds, which is a kind of a figurative way to talk about all the parts of the earth, all the people who are on the earth at that time that are his. And from one end of heaven to the other, that's all those who have been waiting in heaven for this to happen. Not one of God's people will be missing. Besides the prediction of the certainty of our blessed hope, I think the important lesson from this passage is that we are living in the same continuing birth pangs and great tribulation that our fellow believers have patiently endured for over 2,000 years. We're not alone. It's not new. The church has been at it for a long time. I think this can be hard for us in the contemporary church in affluent places of America, like America, because it never promises a better world now. Only promised the hope of his glorious return and a final redemption of our bodies through the resurrection to eternal life and with our resurrected Lord in the new heaven and the new earth. For now, we have the first fruits of the Spirit and that blessed hope in an often hopeless world. And the fellowship of the body of Christ support us. As a longtime friend of mine, in fact, we think about this not too long ago, known for over 50 years almost, who's in the advanced stages of Parkinson's, reminded me here not long ago, said of the passage that Paul wrote to the Corinthians, so we do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. As we look not to the things that are seen, but to things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. So I'm going to invite the musicians, you guys, back up here for my finish one last thought on this. And we're going to go into a communion time, which I'll pass off to Ben here in a minute. The Gospel of John provides a unique record of what Jesus said to his disciples at their last meal together. It was their last meal together. And it was also the meal that sort of instituted the Lord's Supper. But his final words to them before his closing prayer, and I think we miss this way too easy, he says, I have said these things to you that in my name, that in me you may have peace. Don't be alarmed. Don't be panicked. You may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart. I've overcome the world. So, Ben.